It's just after 12 o'clock, and you are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio 102.7 FM, listener-sponsored radio in Western Canada. And it's time now for the Animal Voices show, and the animals are lined up, ready to go, and let them take over the station. The animals are a little stage shy today. They're a little nervous. They're not going to be coming on right away. So we'll just take a moment and try and encourage them.
El 11 de marzo, escucha General Chino Cubano Armando Choi al Biblioteca Central de Vancouver. Choi hablará de su nuevo libro, Nuestra Historia Aún Se Está Escribiendo, la historia de tres generales cubano-chinos en la Revolución Cubana. Choi va a describir cómo, en la lucha contra la discriminación de los negros, los chinos, las mujeres y otros trabajadores, ellos fueron líderes en la Revolución de 56 a 58. Choi sería acompañada con Karen Lee, directora de películas de Vancouver, y Sid Tan, un activista en la comunidad china local. También Armando Choi va a hablar el 12 de marzo a las 12 de la tarde al Centro Asiático, a UBC. Por más información se puede visitar www.vpl.ca o llamar el 604-324-2671.
Welcome to Animal Voices. This show is produced through the cooperative efforts of three local volunteer groups, Earth Save Canada, Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection, and the Vancouver Humane Society. Ideas expressed are not necessarily those of these organizations. My name is Marge Adams, and in the studio with me are technician Alan Jensen, co-host John Pranger, and our frequent contributor Hazel Smeltzer. John will be telling us something about raw food and perhaps doing an interview with Rose Vasily, who is a raw food specialist. Hazel, I hope, is going to tell us one of her wonderful true stories. I have some news items. And then at 12:30, we have a person calling in. Her name is Carol Hine, and Carol is the owner-operator of a pet hospice in Mission, B.C., something we do not have very many of. And the hospice is called SAINTS, and it's SAINTS stands for Senior Animals in Need Today Society. And she has a large number of senior companion animals as well as farm animals in her acreage out in Mission. So we're looking forward to having Carol on a program at 12:30 today. Now, I believe we already have someone on the line. Is that correct, Alan?
Yeah, we have Rose, who's going to talk about raw foods. I think she's calling from Courtney.
Hi, Rose.
And, just a sec, John. I just got to get Rose on the air here. Okay, are you ready?
Hello, Rose. How are you?
Hello there. Fine. It's nice and sunny here.
Oh, great. How's the weather up there?
Perfect.
Oh, not cold, or how is it?
Well, it's cold.
It's cold here, too, yeah.
It's spring-like.
It's too cold for me to eat raw. How do you do it?
I don't find it hard. I guess it's something that it becomes a habit after a while, and it just you feel so much better health-wise. That
a lot of people need that warm feeling in the belly before they can handle the weather. That's not the case, though, is it?
No. And you can spice up your foods, too, using ginger, cayenne, curries, things like that. That also helps.
So they make you perspire a little bit, or they cool you down, actually, don't they?
What was that?
They kind of cool you down, those kinds of reactions. I mean, those are the reactions to cool down your skin. So
initially, though, they feel kind of hot.
Yeah. Well, the cover of your book is beautiful and mouth-watering picture
there.
You. You go to a great deal of trouble to eat raw. How, I mean, I did try it once for a while, and mind you, this was in the summer, and it was blueberry season, and I had the roam of an orchard. So I was eating blueberries night and day, and I was getting so strong, you know, the heavy pails of blueberries would fly out of my hands. I was so vigorous.
All right.
Don't believe it.
But
summer is the ideal time to go raw. I think our body just naturally wants to be raw in the summertime because there are so many luscious fruits and veggies out there.
Yeah, and so full of water, which of course cools you down. How long have you been doing this, Rose?
I've been for a little over 6 years now. I've been eating mainly raw. I say mainly raw because for the last 5 months I've been eating only raw, and there was a year and a half when I ate only raw foods, and my health just feels so, so much better when I do 100% raw.
A lot of people are not motivated to change their habits in any way until, you know, pain comes or something and they have to look into the problem. What motivated you? Anything in particular, or was it, I don't know.
Yeah, it was overweight. I've always had a problem with my weight, and as I'm 55 years old, and so when I started, I was overweight, not feeling so good. I had a lot of food allergies. And I had been vegetarian for a number of years, but
really?
Mainly vegan. But even eating a vegan diet, you can still be eating a lot of fried, sugary types of foods.
That's true. Yeah.
And being not all that healthy. So.
Yeah. And you could eat you could eat white sugar, you could eat almost anything, eliminate meat, but that hardly makes you a conscious vegetarian, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I used to love potato chips and chocolate.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was dark chocolate, so I was still a good vegetarian.
Yeah.
But
that's something I'd like to just clear up if we could. I mean, there are quality matters so much more than I mean, quantity changes quality is a maxim that I learned once. And there's good quality potato chips and there's bad quality potato chips. I think it all depends on the ingredients that go into the making of these things that makes them either good or bad. Not that potato chips are bad per se.
Right. Yeah.
You agree with that?
Yes, yes. Yeah, you want to eat organic if possible because there are so many pesticides and everything in other foods. So you should be trying to eat wholesome kind of food.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I'm really promoting is I know that it's pretty radical for most people to the thought of going to 100% raw foods. But what I'm trying to promote is just to add some raw foods to your diet or more raw foods to your diet because, like, I look at my father, who is 82, and he had been eating, he had no raw foods in his diet. Mm-hmm. His fruits came from a can or were frozen. His veggies were from a can or frozen. So, and that isn't very wholesome, really. So if he could just eat plain raw foods or lightly steamed, that would have made such a difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think a lot of North Americans are like that. They're not eating. They're eating on the run because we have a very busy society and we always feel we don't have enough time to just make a proper meal. But actually with raw foods, I teach raw food classes and I don't like to be in the kitchen a long time. I like to make something that's tasty, nutritious, and looks good, eat it, and get on with my life. And so that's what I really promote is just thinking differently about how you're preparing the food and giving some tasty recipes that work. And that's what people are finding, that it really isn't more trouble to eat raw, that you weren't born knowing how to prepare a cooked meal. You had to learn that. You found it from your mother, your father perhaps, and then you looked at recipe books and you learned how to prepare cooked foods. Then with raw foods it's the same. You just have to think a little differently. One thing that I like to promote is using 5 different tastes in your food: salty, sweet, spicy, sour, and bitter. And if you have a little bit of each one in your recipe, it usually turns out very tasty. You can fiddle with it, but and not in equal proportions, otherwise that's going to taste really weird. But just having each of those tastes in your food is very helpful.
Yeah, so a lot of that would be combining of foods.
Yes, yes, different.
And where would you get your salt from, say? Celery or something? Or?
Celery would be good, or a good sea salt, a good quality sea salt. Yeah.
Now, what about dressings? Do you like to use dressings to make the food more palatable or delicious? Or?
Definitely. Yeah. And some of those dressings might be blended up, something like with sesame seeds in them or sunflower seeds. That kind of thing would be in it. And then maybe cumin and curry for a savory taste or Italian spices in there for Italian there. And maybe some ginger. I have various recipes in my book. Or you can make it really simple. You can just take something like lemon, squeeze some lemon, and maybe olive oil, or squeeze some lemon, and for your fat, have an avocado. That's really nice, too.
Do you ever use tamari, or do you consider that a cooked food?
No, well, that's a live food. That's one of those controversial things. It's not a raw food because you start out with soy, and all soy products have to be cooked before in the processing of them. And then something like there's namu shoyu, which is a soy sauce, which is a live product because it's not pasteurized in the end. But otherwise, tamari is pasteurized.
Oh, dear. Even the organic, it's pasteurized.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of defeats the purpose, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well,
miso is something that you might think about using if you wanted to use soy. I don't really like soy products, but
I love tamari. And tamari, as far as I know, is the runoff liquid from the miso making.
Is that how it's made?
I think that's how it's made. Yeah. So I'm surprised that they would pasteurize it. I know that certain companies, but the more conscientious companies wouldn't.
Well, I know that was part of what I thought was my raw food diet when I first started into it, because I saw that in various recipe books. Was tamari in raw recipe books. And that was one of the things that made me want to write my book, because I've been putting this off for a few years because I kept hoping somebody else would come up with a book that I could really totally stand behind and say, I agree with everything in this book. And it wasn't happening because there was always something like maple syrup would be in a raw recipe book. Well, maple syrup, it takes 40 gallons of sap to boil it down to 1 gallon.
So that's a long time cooking.
Yeah.
What about cane sugar that's sun-dried? That would be good, right? It's just milled. So it would be milled, and then the juices are left out in the sun to dry, and you get the residue, which is the crystallized sugar.
Well, I don't know. That's something I should look into, because
that would
I know
include
we just
that.
Say sugar is out of the question, but I'm going to look into that. Yeah.
And you can buy raw honey, of course. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, well, I'm vegan, so...
Okay, so you have some conscious objection to that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we've got your book here, Uncooking with Raw Rose, Your Guide to Raw Foods. It's free to the second caller, 684-7561. So you're giving an uncooking demonstration, I guess.
That's right, on Wednesday night in the Spec Building, which is 2150 Maple Street at 6th Avenue.
Okay.
So
that's downstairs? The upstairs is a big room there?
The upstairs room, the same room where we're going to be having the potluck on Sunday night, the Earth Save potluck, and I'm the speaker at that potluck, and that's at 6 o'clock on Sunday evening.
Are they a regular thing, those potlucks? Or?
Yeah, they're a monthly.
Monthly thing.
Yeah, I think it's the fourth Sunday of the month.
And do they change venues, or where is it this time, you said?
Well, it's at the Spec Building well.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's off 4th Avenue.
Yeah, and you'll be able to buy my book there, and hopefully when I'm in Vancouver, I'll be placing my book other places. I've sold in the 2 months, a little over 2 months since I launched the book, I self-published this, and I've sold over 400 copies, so... Oh. Now I'm going into the second edition.
Wow. Do you use flowers in your recipes at all? Or?
Yeah, sometimes, as long as you know that it's from a good source, that it wasn't sprayed or whatever.
So what kind of machinery do you use when you're preparing your lunch, let's say? You're not cooking, but you are shredding and whatnot and liquefying things and blending.
Basic things, a knife is your very basic thing.
Knife. Uh-huh.
And then knife, uh-huh. knife and cutting board.
Yes.
And bowl. And you can go anywhere.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's a blender and a food processor. To me, those are the first appliances to buy.
Yeah.
And then after that, you could get a coffee grinder, which sells for under $20 normally, $20.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for things like grinding flax seeds, sesame seeds,
mm-hmm.
Some spices perhaps.
Yeah, and you can crush sesame seeds till it's virtually a paste, can't you?
Yes, and add a little bit
grinder.
Of water, add perhaps a little bit of oil to it too get it going more.
All right. And that makes a good basis for a salad dressing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then and there are just so many variations you can do. Like there was a point I was going through my dill phase where I wanted to put dill in so many things. And now I think my body's cravings for dill have reduced, and because I think our body is always telling us by our cravings what it needs, especially once we've been eating a lot of raw foods for a while, it's able to get the message to us easier because we're listening more.
Yeah. I guess there's no diet that has more roughage than that diet.
No. And one thing that I really promote is, Victoria Butenko, she's my mentor, and she's from Ashland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And she's really into, her family has been eating raw foods for 13 years. And 2 years ago, she came up with the concept of green smoothies whereby you put about 60% fruits in a blender and about 40% greens. And so the smoothie that you're blending up then doesn't taste green, but it's got wonderful nutrition, and it doesn't take a lot of energy to digest it because it's almost like it's pre-digested in the blending of it.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm having right now. I'm having mainly a nettle smoothie with some banana in it and some other fruits, and it's wonderful.
Well, you better hope that the bananas don't go extinct.
Yes, yeah, I know.
There's a threat, isn't there?
There is, yes. Yeah. They're saying in the next less than 10 years, I think it is now, that it may be happening.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I have a caller on the line who's called in with a question.
Sure.
Okay, caller?
Hi. I read something by Vandana Shiva a couple of days ago that said that all soybeans should be fermented. They have a fermentation process or a biological process that in their raw form they're not very good.
Yeah, they are kind of toxic out here.
There's only about 20% of them left that are not GMO.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
wow.
The soy products may be one of the things that, even though it was a great promise, 20 years ago, at this point it's kind of in the hands of the great corporations.
Mm. Yeah.
That don't really care that much about our diet.
No.
No.
So thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
I
still drink a lot of soy milk, and it's very delicious, and, it's organic and flavored, and... Boy, that with some bananas mashed up with some other fruit, incredibly delicious.
Mm.
Oh. But you don't use the soy milk, do you? No,
cocoa. No, I don't.
So you're talking about a raw... I better watch my tongue here.
Yeah.
So you're talking about nettle leaves. Ooh.
Yeah, well, but you put it... I use tongs to put it into the into the blender.
Oh, otherwise it would bite you pretty savagely.
Yeah.
So, yeah, of course, whatever it is, that prickle, it disappears with cooking, but you have to make it disappear some other way. So it's to
in the blender,
it liquefies virtually then.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. And do you use tomatoes?
I do, but it's something I don't overdo with tomatoes. I use it more, in the summer when they're really tasty and when they're really tomatoes, because in the winter... You don't get too many tasty tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
So,
No, that's for sure.
But I will use it for something like I make a barbecue sauce to go on burgers, sun burgers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. How do you make a burger?
Well, the burger is mainly something like carrots, flax seeds, and sunflower seeds, and then some poultry seasoning is in there, poultry spices, and some onion. That's basically what's in it. Mm-hmm. And then that's one of the things that you really need a dehydrator for. And you can get various types of dehydrator. That's the next level of when we were talking about appliances that would be good for raw fooders. A dehydrator is good, and you can get something under $100. You want to make sure, though, that it has a thermostat setting on it, not just an on-off switch, because the whole concept of raw foods is that you don't want to be heating the food above 105 degrees Fahrenheit. Otherwise, you're starting to kill the enzymes.
Mm-hmm.
And some people will say 118 degrees, but I like the 105. I've heard many places, and it resonates with me because they always used to say, well, if you get a fever over 104, 105, you're going to be frying your brain. So I don't want to be frying my food.
So are you noticing improvement in your health all the time? We're almost at the end of the interview, but I'd like to know if you're
definitely.
You do.
Yeah. Well, I lost, just by eating raw foods, I lost over 50 pounds, and that was never being hungry, and eating tasty foods. But then there's more energy, there's more mental clarity. My allergies disappeared. My food allergies totally disappeared. My complexion improved. I look younger.
Yeah.
I feel better. My gums have improved. My elimination is better.
Yeah.
But, you know, just so many things. Don't get indigestion anymore.
Uh-huh.
All those things.
You don't overeat?
Sometimes I overeat, yes.
Still possible to do that, eh?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, I've been having weekly potlucks in my place, and raw potlucks. And so that's the night where we're all probably overindulging. But then the rest of the week, we're eating more simply. We're eating maybe smoothies or fruit in the morning, salads, eating just very basic foods. And it's very satisfying because our body is saying, yeah, I'm getting the nutrients I need. It tastes good.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not time. It doesn't involve a lot of time. Then we go out of our way for that weekly potluck, make something a little more special like nori rolls or just all sorts of pâtés, crackers, things like that.
Yeah, the food's got to look nice too, right?
Yes. Oh, that's definitely part of it.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Rose, and all the best with your seminar, which is once again at...
It's at the Spec Building on Sunday night, and the Spec Building is 2150 Maple at 6th Avenue.
Maple at 6th, okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
And also, I'll just mention people can visit my raw site for more information.
Yes.
It's my website. It's www.rawrose.com.
Well, raw, raw, raw.
Raw, raw, raw.
All right.
Okay, thanks,
thanks
a lot,
for talking
John.
To us. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Ah, very interesting interview, John. Enjoyed that and a lot of information. Now, Alan, could we have a little interlude of music? Thank you, Alan. I just have a few news briefs here from the Vancouver Humane Society newsletter. One, Air Canada has banned all animals except service animals from the cabins of their aircraft. Dr. Donald Stark, a Vancouver allergist, lobbied for the ban after a study that detected peanut dust in cabin air filters. Don't know that animals would cause that. He hasn't studied the animal allergens in the aircraft, but claims we have to give priority to human health over animal health, and claims that asthmatics could have serious attacks if exposed to pet dander. Here's a good news one about free-range egg laying hens. The Associated Residence Halls at the University of Iowa made permanent their spring 2006 introduction of cage-free eggs at three dining facilities that cumulatively use over 1 million eggs per year. Tufts University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Marist College, Vassar College, Roger Williams University, Emmanuel College, and the University of New Hampshire are among over 100 U.S. facilities that no longer use eggs from caged hens. So that is really good news. And what about this one? Livestock are one of the most significant contributors to today's most serious environmental problems, stated the senior author of a UN report from the Food and Agricultural Organization released recently. Farm animals are responsible for almost a fifth of the pollution blamed for global warming. The growth of livestock farming is responsible for water pollution, reduction of forests, and gas emissions. So there's some fodder for the people who want to get their friends and neighbors converting to veganism or at least vegetarianism. Now, there was something else I wanted to mention about birds. I wonder if I can find that. Just a moment. Oh, dear. What have I done? Sorry, I'm confused. But I want to tell you about an issue that I think is very timely, and that's the feeding of birds through your garden and how you can change the attractiveness or increase the attractiveness of the garden so that you'll get more birds coming. And here it is. Now, undoubtedly, the best thing you can do for wild birds is provide natural habitat with long-lasting year-round feeding opportunities. Try planting native plants that produce food and or shelter. Now, here's some examples of those plants. Hawthorn, viburnum, native flowers like cornflowers, if let go to seed, that's important, so there's a year-round source of food. They provide great natural food all winter long. Now, coniferous trees provide important shelter, so do branch debris and leaf piles. Before long, the newsletter claims, you will notice a steady stream of new feathered friends appearing in your area. Grab your binoculars and a bird identification book, available at most libraries, and start enjoying the wonderful world of birding. And also there's a website, www.birdwatching.com, and you'll get a lot of birding tips there. So that's just a few ideas from the Vancouver Humane Society. Now, do we have Carol on the line? Yeah, we've got Carol Hine, who is the owner-operator of Saints, which is a hospice for pets and farm animals. Hello, Carol. Are you there?
Hi, I'm Marg. How are you?
I'm very well. Wonderful to have you on the line.
Thank you.
Now, I know you have a lot of things to tell us, Carol. I'm quite excited about learning about your hospice. I think it's just wonderful that you're doing this and have been doing it for quite some time. Can you tell us how you got started?
Well, it was a learning process. It was a path that we just sort of started going down. We got involved with animal rescue many, many years ago, about 15 years ago, and started out with dogs and then went to cats. But all along the way, we saw an increasing need for something for seniors and special needs animals because there just isn't anything in place for them. So I think probably what happened is we just started taking in more and more and more, and before we knew it, we were sort of really sitting with a facility that was full of senior and special needs animals, but we weren't official. We just had a lot of unadoptable animals that couldn't find homes. And that's when we made the quantum leap and decided, you know, this is something that needs to be our focus. And then we started working towards that.
And then at that time, did you move to Mission onto farmland?
Yeah, originally we rented a 5-acre piece of property that it was okay, but it was a trailer, and it was a very rough start for us. And then I kept my eye out looking for the perfect piece of property, and it was really amazing how this piece came up because basically I saw the property mid-November. I put an offer, and it was accepted immediately, and we had possession of it by December 1st. And the property was made for us. It had everything that we needed now for the animals, and it had the capacity for future expansion.
And you did that in 2004, I believe, didn't you?
Yeah, it was December of 2004 that we started, we officially became saints. And then it was December of 2005 that we actually purchased our permanent property.
That's a wonderful name.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a hard time coming up with a name. Mm-hmm. And originally it was supposed to be Hope's House. Wee Hopeful Bug was a little cat that I had had for many years that was an irritable bowel colitis cat. She had been a distemper survivor. And her intestinal tract was ruined. And she couldn't be managed in the shelter. She couldn't be managed in a family home. And when I finally decided that I was going to start Saints, I basically was building it for Wee Hopeful Bug and to meet all of her needs. And mm-hmm. so Hope actually died about 6 months ago. And I've said that she's the heart of Saints. But it was supposed to be Hope's House. And when we applied for that name through Victoria, that name was gone. So then we had to come up with another name, and that's how Saints came to be.
Oh, I see.
And Saints stands for Senior Animals in Need Today Society.
Right. Yeah, that's great. Now, you have 3 acres in Mission, and that, I suppose when all said and done, that's quite a handy location, isn't it, to services and so on that you would need.
It has everything that we need. We're rural enough that we can, you know, we have a bit of freedom in certainly being able to take in the farm animals and that kind of thing. You know, really, on a weekend, we're a short drive from Vancouver, so a lot of our visitors that come up from Vancouver, you know, it's an hour drive out for them, but they, you know, they come planning on that and, you know, stop and have lunch along the way, spend a few hours here with the animals, really enjoy themselves, and then they go home again, and they felt like they've spent, you know, a good, valuable day.
And you do have a great variety of species, I know. Maybe you could just mention a few, could you?
We pretty much have everything now. We have our rabbit area contains rabbits, guinea pigs, and hedgehogs. The main shelter has cats and dogs in it. We have a chicken area. Most of our chickens, believe it or not, and roosters have come from downtown Vancouver. Our barn has sheep and llamas and pigs and senior horses. And a couple of our horses are 30 years old. We have a couple of donkeys that are here. And we just pretty much have a little bit of everything.
Are they fenced off, so keep separated some of these species, or are they able to wander around?
All of the farm animals, I mean, they just live together as a herd. They just live together as a group. All of our animals are able to interact. That's part of the criteria for them in order to be here. So the dogs can move freely from a dog area into the kitchen and run into cats and not have it an issue. We have, on our 3 acres, we have a very large pond, and our dogs love to swim and chase sticks. Even though they're old and wrecked, they don't know it. And so, you know, when we go out into the fields, the dogs are with the horses and the sheep and the llamas, and, you know, sometimes we have to teach them not to chase them, but most of the times it's amazing how peacefully all the animals here coexist.
That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Now, does it take them a little time to adjust, though, when they get put into this new milieu? It must be quite different than most of them are used to.
It depends where they're coming from. If these are beloved family pets who have lost their homes because of death or illness, you know, coming here is very difficult for them. Most of them traditionally live in single pet homes with a quiet senior elderly lady, and so coming here is really a huge adjustment for them, and most of them make it quite well. The animals that are coming in from the pounds and the shelters generally are animals that really never had in their entire 15 or 16 years of life, never really had a home where they were valued and they were loved, and people went to such extents to make sure that they were happy and comfortable. So they come here, and, you know, they enjoy it as soon as they get here, because all of a sudden there's fun things happening, and there's people taking them for walks and playing stick with them. We order pizzas in for them occasionally at night. When we have volunteer meetings and volunteer picnics, all of the dogs are with us, and they're eating exactly the same kind of food we're having. So if we're barbecuing, they're eating barbecued, and if we're eating garlic bread, they're eating garlic bread, and, you know, and they totally expect it.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
What a way to end a life, because otherwise these pound creatures would be in little cages, wouldn't they? I shouldn't say little cages, but in runs, perhaps. Yeah.
It's unfortunate, you know. It's a difficult way for an animal to go, because, you know, the pounds traditionally are set up to move animals through, either to return them to their homes and families or to get them adopted. They're not meant to be homes. They are holding facilities until the animals can be moved to a more appropriate places. The problem with the animals that we take in is that there isn't an appropriate place for them to go. They're not adoptable. People are afraid to adopt them because of their age and because they may have medical issues. Mm-hmm. You know, the other rescue groups which take on animals will occasionally take on seniors and special needs, but they can't fill up primarily with them because these animals don't move. Wherever they go mm-hmm. tends to be, you know, a lifelong commitment to them.
And some of them do live quite some time, I guess. Others would die in months, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, some of them we would lose within a month or two. Some of them we take in and we know they're actively dying, and so we get them in, we get them on medications, we get them comfortable, and we work really hard to make sure that the time that they have has value to them. Some of them come in and we fully expect that, you know, they are weeks to months to dying. And, you know, once we get them on the proper cardiac medications and we get their pain under control with their arthritis and that, you know, they go on for years. Mm-hmm. I mean, Bill is 17 years old now. He's a hugely overweight lab with mouth cancer, and he's still running in the field.
How long have you had him?
He came in at 10 years old, and people wouldn't adopt him then because they said he was too old.
Imagine that.
Yeah, and 7 years later, Bill is still trucking around the fields with us and just having a blast.
Wonderful. Now, I guess one of the most difficult problems you have is rejecting animals who need you.
That's probably the hardest thing we do on any daily basis, because generally it's easier when we know the animals are not appropriate and that there are other groups or facilities that can help them. But when, because of space, you know, we're contacted about an animal that really needs us and has nowhere to go, we know that when we say no, that animal probably is going to be euthanized.
Oh, yeah, that would be hard to bear, I know.
Yeah.
But you do have to do that fairly often, I guess, don't you, with the limitations that you have on space.
Yeah, we can only take in animals that we can care for. And certainly if we take in too many, then none of the animals are going to be happy. So, you know, we have to have limits on what we can take in, what we financially can take care of. The vet bills are huge around here. You know, I think last year they were running $20,000 or $25,000 just for their medical care.
Now, let's you know, maybe some of our listeners would be interested in making a contribution. I'm certainly intending
to. Anyone who makes the donations to Saints, they're totally tax deductible. We have information on how to donate on our website, which I can give you now if you want.
Yes, good.
It's www.saintsrescue.ca.
Saintsrescue.ca.
Yeah. And if somebody's interested in donating, they can certainly make a donation right online through PayPal, or there's contact information if they wanted to send a check. Mm-hmm. We really appreciate any help we can get.
In other words, there's an address that we could send
yeah.
to. Okay.
Yeah.
Some of us are dinosaurs.
And I have to go for the dinosaurs when I make up my web. Could you spell that for me again?
It's,
the website?
It's www.saintsrescue.
Saints. S-A-I-N-T?
S.
S?
Yeah.
Okay.
R-E-S-C-U-E.
.ca.
.ca.
Yeah,
okay. All one word.
Okay.
Thank you.
Now, Carol, I imagine you have a lot of volunteers, because you just couldn't do this by yourself.
We don't have a lot of volunteers. We have a core handful of people who are incredibly dedicated, who go way beyond the call of duty to care for these guys. They love them. They love the animals here, and they will do everything they can to look after them, but it's a very small core of handful of volunteers. What we do have is we have lots of casual volunteers, people who live in Vancouver, want to come out for the day and really get hands-on experience working with the animals, and so they'll come up on the weekend, you know, maybe once or twice a year and spend some time helping us, and we really value those people coming out to help us too.
That's wonderful. I should think that some of those people have children, and they want to expose the children to this compassion for animals that you show and all the other volunteers demonstrate.
And it's not just that. I really encourage families mm-hmm. to come together, because, you know, even if you're having a difficult relationship with your 13 or 14-year-old teenager and you're not having a lot to talk about, I mean, you can go to a movie with them, you can go to the mall, you can do the traditional things, you can come out and spend a day at Saints, and I can guarantee that when you go home at dinner that night, your family is going to have an incredible conversation about who saw what animal did who to what, you know. I mean, it's just a whole joyful experience, and those are valuable experiences for families to be spending together.
Mm-hmm. Certainly a lot more memorable than going mm-hmm. to another movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. One other thing that crosses my mind is food. It must be a very, very large amount of food that you go through in a month, huh?
Many hundreds of pounds. We're lucky. Most of our food for the cats and dogs are donated. A lot of the vet clinics, a lot of the pounds and shelters support us. And our food for the dogs and cats is generally donated, and we're okay with that. The barn animals is a different story. People forget that we have rabbits and we have pigs and we have, you know, we have sheep and we have horses. And so we actually have to purchase their food ourselves. Mm-hmm. The senior horse, I mean, the horses are all on special diets, so that's okay. But the barn itself is a huge expense on feeding.
Oh, yes, I can imagine. Mm-hmm. Now, Carol, we always love to hear stories about animals, and I just bet you have a lot.
Sometimes it's hard to pick which one you're going to tell.
Do you have a happy one, or two, or three?
Oh, I have many happy ones. You'll like this one. About a year ago, I was contacted about a little 16-year-old poodle whose senior caregiver had fallen and was going into a care facility, and she was absolutely devastated that her dog could not go with her. So her family was unable to take the dog. They actually traveled out of the country quite a bit. So they contacted us to see if Pippa could come and live here, which she did. In the meantime, while Pippa was living here, there was a woman who had several years ago adopted a little difficult dog for me by the name of Mighty Mouse. And she, you know, she just loved him and adored him. And Mighty Mouse. he was a little bit of a bugger. But she adopted him, and he did eventually pass away, and she came and got another dog from me by the name of Milo. Out of the blue, I get a call from Joanna, who has Milo and did have Mighty Mouse, and she said, do you have Pippa there? And I said, yes, I do. Well, apparently she used to volunteer for a senior center, and many, many years ago she used to walk Pippa for her elderly owner. So here's my happy story. Joanna has come and adopted Pippa and taken her home, and several times a week she takes Pippa to the seniors facility, and Pippa lays on her bed with her previous beloved owner, and they're both, it's just one of those really happy stories where in the end everybody got what they needed.
Wonderful. So,
yeah.
Sounds great. Now, Hazel, one of our contributors to this show, has a question. I showed her this picture of you in the Vancouver Sun last December,
mm-hmm.
and one of the critters you had with you, she thought she recognized.
Okay, who's that?
Now, listen a minute.
Hi there. This is Hazel.
Hi, Hazel.
I was very intrigued with that little pug that you had there on your lap.
Wilbur.
Oh, Wilbur.
Yeah.
So he looked like my pug that I had to find a home for, and he was elderly, and we sort of lost contact with what happened to him. And I was saying to Marge, oh, my God, I wonder if that's my dog.
It's not. Wilbur came in when he was quite young. Was just over a year old when he came in, had been through many homes. He was a typical poorly bred pug that had been purchased in a pet store, and he was poorly socialized. He had very bad toilet skills. He went through three or four homes. Each one got progressively worse. Each one got progressively more violent in their attempts to house train him. By the time I got him, he was about a year and a half, 2 years old. He was totally and completely emotionally traumatized. He never has been able to be house trained. He's always been a problem for him. He has some really bad habits that he developed from having his face rubbed in feces and that kind of stuff, so he's actually a fecal eater. So he never became adoptable because he just was too difficult for most people to manage in a home. And since then, he's now about 7 years old, but because he's such a poorly bred specimen of a pug, he has a lot of health issues, and he's now in end-stage kidney failure. He's totally blind, and he's a very brittle, difficult-to-control diabetic. Having said all that about Wilbur and his problems, Wilbur is one of the nicest dogs anybody's ever met in the world. He's just a sweet dog.
Oh, that's...
But I'm sorry to say it's not your guy. Oh. I can't set your mind to ease on that.
Oh, well, I'm sure he's okay. It's just that as soon as you see, if you've ever had a pug,
mm-hmm. they're pretty special.
They are awesome.
Yeah.
And when you see a pug, you just can't help but wonder.
They always look like they're suffering.
Yeah.
They work on that just so they can get what they want.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It looks like a bred-in wrinkles, you know, the forehead all furrowed. And
They're not a greatly bred dog. You know, they have problems with breathing. They're actually, you know, their buggy eyes, which are so cute, I mean, in order to get that, sometimes they end up with problems like encephalitis, which is, or sorry, hydroencephalus, which is water on the brain.
Yeah,
and all those add to further problems that they have.
What were they bred for then?
Originally,
I
do believe that pugs were one of the first companion dogs that were bred. I don't believe that they, I could be wrong on this. I'm not a huge, I don't know a lot about breeding and why a lot of the especially the smaller dogs were bred. Most dogs started out as working dogs, but I don't believe that pugs actually ever had a job. I think they were a companion animal.
A lot of such dogs are used to catch rats, I think.
Yeah. I don't know if pugs were one of them or not.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks, Carol. Gosh, it's been a real treat having you on our show.
Well, thank
unfortunately,
you for having me.
The time has just about run out on this, but maybe another time we could hear some more of your stories.
Great.
Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You've been listening to an interview with Carol Hines, who is the owner-operator of Saints, a pet hospice. Located in Mission, B.C. Wonderful operation. I'm so impressed with what Carol has told us. Now, perhaps we could have a little music, Alan.
Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, be it olive, safflower, or crude. For cooking, for cars, take a rocket to the stars, for a back rub, romantic rendezvous. In your engine, on your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through. Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue. If you drive a big V8, it's time to celebrate. They're gonna fight a war for you. To keep gas prices cheap, so when you drive or when you sleep, you can do it in an air-conditioned room. For driving is your right, so let's get out there and fight. You can read that in the Constitution. I go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue. Here we go now. I go anywhere to fight for oil, be it olive, safflower, crude. For cooking, for cars, take a rocket to the stars, for a back rub, romantic rendezvous. In your engine, on your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through. Oh, I go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue. For oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue. For a place to attack, why not attack Iraq? They've got coconut and palm oil and crude. They invaded Kuwait, so let's not hesitate. We can blow up a country or two. If it's oil or it's Greece, we don't have time for peace. Waging war is what we want to do. Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
Everybody!
I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, be it olive, safflower, or crude. For cooking, for cars, take a rocket to the stars, for a back rub, romantic rendezvous. In your engine, on your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through. Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil. It's gonna be a great fight. Should only take a fortnight to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
What an irreverent gentleman is that, Dan Alliance. Here's another irreverent gentleman who just doesn't give enough respect to the medical profession. And that was written in... it was a speech given to the Anti-Vivisection Association in The Hague, Holland, in 1931. And this is by Dr. P. Pyle, who is a physician in Holland. In order to be healthy and avoid illness, we must live hygienically, that is, live simply and naturally. And for this purpose, one doesn't need a single school that works with a laborious system of medicine geared to animal experimentation. All that is needed, beside a suitable diet based on plants and minerals, is the simple use of sun, light, air, rational clothing, and so on. And last but not least, proper housing and a good mental balance. And this holds true even if the body becomes ill, in which case the non-vivisectionist art of healing may possibly play a part. Trespassing against the cosmic laws produces illness, and this trespass becomes all the more negatively woven into the lot of humankind the more mankind kicks against these laws, as we explained here, which is what the vivisection-based system of medicine, among others, does, which violates the cosmic laws of violating life in violating life. The vivisectionist allopathy, by contrast, dreadfully increases mankind's debit balance. One only needs to think of the fact that at present some 3 million animals fall victim to it every year, not to mention the thousands of vivisections carried out on people. That's about 4 billion animals in our time. With a system of medicine that bases itself on animal experiments, we evermore reduce our knowledge of the nature of illness and impede healing. Cuvier said, "One must not force nature's secrets from her. One must observe nature. Then one learns everything." The allopathic school of medicine, on the contrary, does nothing but constantly snatch nature's secret from her in the most cruel and cunning manner. It thereby corrupts the students, causes the doctor to enjoy no confidence anymore among the people, brings the profession into disrepute among the public, and prepares the way for vivisection on humans, which is what one can arrive at through only one short step from vivisection on animals, which under the practice of this school is a senseless reflex action. Written in 1931 by Dr. P. Pyle, a physician in Holland.
Thank you for that, John. Now I have a little bit of something else. Let's see. Give it a story. About a minute. Do you have anything just a very short? Okay. Well, anyway, let me.
We have about 4 or 5 minutes.
Do we?
Then I could say something.
Okay. Then Hazel has a story to finish up with.
Hazel.
Yeah. I'm still just so intrigued by this lady, Carol, that has this wonderful little farm here in Mission. And I really related to her because I had a hobby farm myself because I had teenagers, a group of unruly teenagers. And the only way I could get my kids to come home from school was I had a hobby farm, and they were each given a goat to milk. And those goats had to be milked twice a day, and the kids would have to get up before they went to school. They caught a bus because we lived out in a rural area, and they would have to catch a bus, but they'd have to get up early, 5 in the morning. It was still dark in the barn when it was winter, and we'd have to put the lights on and milk the goats and feed them. They would feed them, put them in some kind of like a contraption thing, and that you know, that their heads go in, they can eat, and they're eating this wonderful feed, and then they can milk them because they're difficult, you know, they're kicking, and they're always kicking the milk over. They're a little difficult.
We're trying to knock you over.
Yeah, they're doing that too, and then they'd have to be home from school in the afternoon because the goats were waiting, and if they were late. Well, for one thing, if they were late, they'd miss their bus, so they'd have to find their own way home, or, you know, they'd have to walk. And the goats were just, as soon as they would hear the kids' voices, they'd just start, you know, calling and calling and crying because they were so uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. They wanted to be milked. Mm-hmm. And, but it was great because at first the kids, they liked them. It was summertime. It was fun, but then they wanted to socialize, but I had really good control over those guys because they loved their goats and they didn't like their goats to suffer. They saw how they suffered. And it's a wonderful thing because it does teach your kids to become better human beings and more compassionate. And I just think it's wonderful that Carol is doing this work and mission and that people are bringing their kids out instead of sitting in the movie theater. And it's true. My kids now are adults, they're in their 30s, early 30s, and you know, when we lived on that farm, it was hard. It was hard times. It was tough. It's hard work, and I admire the work. I understand totally where she's coming from, but my kids now, they talk about how wonderful stories that we had on the farm, and they talk about it a lot about how
did
it really
sell the milk
them.
Too?
We couldn't sell it because you know you have the license and all that. But we had friends that would buy it. We drank it. My husband made a lot of cheese, and we had so much milk. I mean, we fed the milk.
If you had milk, you must have had little what do you call them, kids?
Yeah. Well, what happened is
young goats.
That's right. You have to have, but that didn't happen. We had this wonderful man that had all these goats, and he lent them to us. It was a teaching thing, teaching us because we were just hobby farmers and we were learning. And so he taught us everything, and they were never, he was like a Seventh-day Adventurist.
Adventist.
We always call it adventurist. He would have them on this mega doses of vitamins all the time. They weren't given any drugs or anything at all. But we made cheese, and we fed a lot of the milk to our chickens, which loved the milk. And then the chickens loved the whey, too. And we had pigs, and we fed the whey to the pigs. And our dog and our cats. And it was cute because all the cats would sit there. We had barn cats, and they would sit there, and the kids would squirt, you know, the milk from the teat. And then they would all sit there and lap it up. And, yeah, it was a fantastic, wonderful experience. And I just loved my hobby farm, and I think this lady's wonderful.
Mm. And where is she located?
I think she's in Mission, isn't she?
Yeah, she's in Mission. It must be a very hard-working lady. Yeah, I believe she's a nurse. Nurses work hard, too.
You have to do a lot of nursing skills on the farm. Like, we did a lot of little funny little surgeries and things that you had to do. We had this one. Do we have time for just one quick thing?
I'm afraid
no.
not. We're
oh,
just
well.
About out of things. It's next week.
Next week.
Okay. Good enough. Thank you, Hazel. You always have such interesting tales to tell. Now, I want to thank the listening audience for tuning in to CFRO 102.7 FM on your radio dial, and invite you to tune in again next Friday at 12 noon. We will be back with another interesting show, and probably with Carl Loskin back from South Africa. So we're looking forward to his presence. Maybe I'm jumping the gun a bit. But he will be back in town anyway by that time. Thank you. Good afternoon.